The topic is the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Is peace possible? I said the other day that my own goals for these sessions are really, first of all, to try to make the topic, help people feel that the topic is one that we can discuss. Because I think one of the things about the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict frequently is we're nervous about even talking about it. Partly because it depresses us. I said the other day, it's a kind of conflict where people, I think with good reason, in terms of the history of it, sometimes feel that it may be a conflict that's not resolvable. And by and large, we're humans, like to talk about things we can do something about. A second reason I think we're afraid of it is, or nervous about it, is because it can be so emotional, particularly if, I assume most of us here, or all of us maybe are Christians, if we talk about it with Jewish friends or Jews whom we know or Arab Americans, it just seems so loaded emotionally that we're nervous about it for that reason. And so my goal for the week is really to try to help us feel as if it is a topic that we know it's important, but that it's not only important, but one that we can talk about. And even that we might be able to talk about with people who have strong feelings about it, either because they're connected to the conflict in some way or they've developed strong feelings for whatever reason. And that another goal is that we come away feeling that that it's neither quite as complicated as we thought, nor perhaps as simple as we thought. And the first day, what we did is sort of look at history, and we looked at it in two different ways. One, based on our own memories, and I asked people to sort of remember things, an event or some experience related to the conflict that you had, or that comes to your mind. And we listed those, and that sort of began to identify for us the chronology of the conflict in terms of our memories. And memory is a very important way that any of us do history or do viewpoint on any issue. What we remember, what's important to us. And second, we actually looked at, as ridiculous as it sounds, history beginning in 3,500 years before Christ and coming up to 1992. Sort of marking some dates, some events, like the birth of Muhammad, the birth of Jesus, the destruction of the Jewish temple, marking some events over the whole span of history that have bearing on this conflict, which is obviously very immediate and very today and very alive. But it has background to it that sort of weighs on it, and in some sense must be taken into account if we're going to deal with it. Today, what we're going to do is look at both the Arab and the Israeli views toward peace, toward the possibility of peace. And I would say that there are two things that are important in general about what we're going to do. First, there has been a tendency in this conflict to think of it as an Arab-Israeli conflict. That is, a conflict between Israel as a state and the Arab states, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and to leave the Palestinians out of it. And if you look at bibliographies about this conflict, up until the last 10 years, many of the bibliographies will list the conflict under the category Arab-Israeli. And the Palestinian people sort of get left out of the naming of the conflict. In recent years, I think there's been another tendency, which also I think is a problem, to think of the conflict only as a conflict between the Palestinians and Israel, and to leave the Arab states out of it. And what I'm suggesting, and by the title of the whole week and by today's session, is that it's important to look at Arab states, at Israel, and at the Palestinian people as three pieces of this conflict. Tomorrow's session, we're going to look at the question, is peace really possible? Frankly, I think however sophisticated we are in our knowledge about the Middle East, one question which it's still very difficult emotionally and intellectually to answer is it really possible? And I want us to look at that tomorrow. And then the last day, look at the question, very important for us as Americans, what can the United States do, and therefore really what can we do as Americans to help the possibilities for peace in the Middle East? Now, what I've got up on the board, and I think you can at least read the top line, is the actors, the sort of primary actors in the Middle East in this conflict. That is to say, four Arab states, Egypt, Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria, all bordering on Israel, and then the Palestinian people and Israel. And if one problem has been that the tendency to sort of talk about the conflict, Arab-Israeli, leave the Palestinians out, or Israeli-Palestinian, leave the Arab states out, another problem has been when we talk about who's interested in peace, a tendency to simplify it and say, Israel's interested in peace, but the Arabs aren't. Or it seems to me the Palestinians are ready to compromise now, but the Israelis aren't. And what I'm suggesting in the way I'm going to talk today is that it ain't so simple. It's not so complicated you can't understand it, but it's not so simple as to say they want peace and they don't. That in fact, each of the parties in this conflict have certain interests in peace, in a peaceful, negotiated peaceful settlement, but each party also has certain constraints that hold them back from giving what's necessary to make a real peace. And that's the way I want to talk about each of the parties. And I want to remind us that it would have been good, and I didn't do this, I should have, if I had had another paper somewhere around in the air here, which would have listed some other actors which aren't directly involved, but play a role. Think of them. Iran, not up there. Iraq, not up there. Libya, not up there. Tunisia, Morocco, not up there. Algeria, also the Soviet Union, at least in the history of the conflict, now Soviet Union gone, but various Eastern European actors, Western European actors, France, Britain, etc., the Scandinavian countries, the Netherlands, the United States, Japan, Saudi Arabia, oil. You know, so remember that around these primary actors are some other actors that play a role, that influence, and maybe that'll come out more in the questions. But I want to look at the primary actors, and I want to look at each one in terms of some interests they have in peace and some constraints. And I would say if people wanted to, if you're interested in this and sort of pursuing it some more, I would say taking, you know, just noting down these phrases, either now or after class, may be a good thing because you'll then have at least some kind of an outline of what I've said about it, and obviously that may differ with what you think or what others might say. First, I want to look at Egypt, and I want to look at Egypt first because Egypt is the only Arab country to have made peace with Israel. And that's already a breath of fresh air in a conflict in which, about which we sometimes think there'll never be peace. Or sometimes we think they'll never want peace. Israelis frequently, even today, will say, but the Arabs don't really want peace. Well, a now contradictory fact is that Egypt made peace. And there is still the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. Cold as it may be, it's still there. What were Egypt's interests in making peace? Well, first, I think, was a sense, deep sense, in Egyptian society and that President Sadat gave leadership to, that they wanted to avoid another war. They had had the 48 war, the 56 war, the 67 war, the 73 war, and they had lost them all, which made them even less attracted to the next war than they might have been if they had won them or had done better in them. And they wanted to avoid another war. Egyptians were sick and tired of war. Egyptian mothers didn't want any more of their children lost in wars. Second, Egypt wanted to get back occupied lands, lands that it had lost to Israel in the 67 war. And on your map, if you look at it, I think probably, just seeing which side, probably the side with the, you should have a side that has a single, no wait, let's see. Why do I have, let me see, yours. My goodness, these are crazy. They've got the same two things on. No, they don't. I'm sorry, yeah. I think it's best to look at the side with the two maps on it, because there you see the countries we're talking about. Lower left-hand corner, Egypt. Then upper middle, Lebanon. Then Jordan, with Amman as its capital. And Syria, Israel. And then when I talk about occupied territories, I'm talking about areas. The area where the word Egypt is part of the Sinai Peninsula, and that whole peninsula was captured by Israel in the 67 war. A war which you can argue until the cows come home, who started it? But in any case, it happened. Both sides, I'd say, contributed to starting it. And Egypt lost the whole Sinai Peninsula. I'm going to talk about the Gaza Strip. It's there. It's just a little piece of land on the Mediterranean, just right there near the line of Egypt. The Gaza Strip. Then that dotted line that's sort of shaped like a face almost, with Jerusalem there at the place of the indentation. That's the West Bank, and it was controlled by Jordan until 67. Israel captured that in the course of that war, 67. Then up to the right of Nazareth, you'll see a little bit of a sort of dotted line and circle there, and that's the Golan Heights with Syria. I'll come back to those, but I just want to say they're on your map in case you haven't sort of visualized them. So Egypt wanted to get back occupied land, the whole Sinai. The Sinai was important not only because it was Egyptian, which is important for countries, they don't want to lose their territory, but it also had oil. And so Egypt wanted to get it back because it oil revenues was very important for any country, particularly a country like Egypt with tremendous economic and social problems. Third, in Egypt's interest in peace, tremendous social and economic problems in Egypt. Some of you have visited Cairo, and you know what I mean by saying that it's amazing that it even works at all. There are 16 million people in daytime in Cairo. The sewer system, they still say, which was built by the French, was built for 4 million. So the weight of the population of Egypt, and in particular in Cairo, on the resources, human, economic, natural resources, is incredible. And another interest that Egypt had in achieving peace was that they wouldn't have to spend so much on preparing for the next war and could devote more resources to economic and social problems. Sadat promised grandly to the Egyptian people that if they followed him in this route to make peace with Israel, their economic situation would become much better. That's one of the reasons, by the way, that Egyptians grew rather bitter about Sadat, because after there was peace with Israel, in fact, the economic situation didn't improve much at all. In some ways, it worsened. But that was an interest that Egypt had. A fourth one is to undermine today, particularly in maintaining the peace with Israel and helping to achieve a wider peace, to undermine Islamic extremists, because Islamist extremists attack the government for all of the social and economic problems and for having made peace with Israel. The Egyptian government would like to see the peace broadened and extended in part and be more successful, a more successful peace, to undermine the appeal of Islamic extremists. Another reason is Egypt was interested in improving and is interested in good relations with the U.S. And given that U.S. is interested in peace and in Israel's security, if Egypt can help in that, that's a good point for Egypt in terms of getting more aid from the United States, having better relations with the United States. And the last one is that Egypt believes that it's the leader of the Arab world. When Egypt made peace with Israel, you know, the Arab countries all broke off relations with Egypt and sort of put Egypt out of the Arab League. And when you went to Egypt and you would talk about this and are you concerned about Egypt getting back in the Arab League, and Egyptians, particularly Egyptians who have a sense of pride in Egypt, they would say, it isn't a question of our getting back with the Arabs, it's a question of the Arabs getting back with Egypt. And that sense of that Sadat had when he made peace, Sadat's idea of what he was doing was not that he was going off in a different direction than the rest of the Arab states, but that he was reading the will of the Arab states and giving the appropriate Egypt leadership to that will. It didn't work out that way, at least for then, but that was his idea, that Egypt was leading the Arab world to make peace. And even today in the Madrid peace process, Egypt's role, as it sees itself, is trying to help the Arab parties and help Israel and help the Palestinians in the way that pharaonic Egypt should help these parties to come to some realistic peace. All right, so those are interests, but there are also constraints. One of them is Egypt's interests, the interests of other Arab states, that Egypt, on the one hand, has this sense of pride that it's the leader of the Arab world, but on the other hand, it doesn't want to be so out of sync with the rest of the Arab world, both at a cultural, political, ideological level and at the level of economic relations and so forth. They don't want to be, they don't want to alienate Saudi Arabia. They need aid, they need oil, you know, sold cheaply and so forth. So the interests of the other Arab parties sort of push on Egypt to not go too far too fast, not compromise too much. A second one, the Palestinian issue, and this will be true of all the Arab states, that the Palestinian issues, to the extent that Egypt made a peace which solved the Palestinian issue, it would have been a great thing for Egypt. To the extent that Egypt made a peace which seemed to leave the Palestinians out, which is what happened, it was a bad mark against Egypt because of the way the Palestinian issue is a kind of issue of the heart for many, many Arabs. A feeling that, you know, these are our people, they have suffered injustice, we ought to support them. And whatever you say about Arab states putting their own interests first, that's true. There's also a deep sense of support and identification with the Palestinians. And therefore, the constraint on Egypt in terms of how that can they do anything they want to make peace? No, they have to take into account what's going to happen to the Palestinians in this. That doesn't mean that's decisive. It just means it's one of the constraints, which in the case of Egypt making peace with Israel, they sort of rode over, but it cost them in terms of relations after that. Third, internal opposition. There are groups, politically organized groups, opposed to peace with Israel in Egypt. And so any government of Egypt that's going to try to make peace has to be aware of what it's losing in terms of what's going on in the streets, political opposition groups. And then I said economic and social problems. On the one hand, they're a motivation to make peace, but on the other hand, they're so preoccupying, they're also a constraint. They're also a constraint. Just as in our own country today, the attention to domestic problems, in a certain sense, could be a motivation for the U.S. to play a world leadership role, because to the extent that the world is better, healthier, better organized, less oriented toward war, more oriented toward economic development, that could be helpful in resolving our domestic problems. But to the extent that domestic problems are so preoccupying, they're a constraint on a Clinton administration to be active in the world level. Well, similarly for an Egyptian government. The problems are so overwhelming, they're a constraint as well as an incentive to make peace. So that's Egypt. Lebanon. And I picked Lebanon next because in the sort of theories about peace in the Middle East, at least among many Israelis and some people outside the region, the idea was that Lebanon would be the second Arab country to make peace. And the reason was, according to the theory, that Lebanon needed peace very badly. And for what reasons? Well, one, as I put right up here, is the whole question of whether Lebanon can exist as a state, as a nation state. And the way in which the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict plays itself out on top of Lebanon. Have you ever done these, have you ever seen these sheets where you have a map and you put another page over it that's sort of clear, but it has different lines on it? Well, if you picture Lebanon, one way is picture Lebanon. Lebanon has its own problems, relations of different groups in Lebanon, economic problems, political power-sharing problems. But then on top of all Lebanon's problems, you have to put the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because Palestinians, when they were refugees, moved in large numbers to Lebanon. And they began to organize themselves and form a kind of Palestinian state right in Lebanon and to fight Israel across the Lebanese border. Well, what would happen? Israel would then fight the Palestinians across the Lebanese border and the Lebanese would all get caught in the middle. Similarly, Syria and Israel have sort of fought each other over Lebanon. And so from the Lebanese perspective, the idea of peace, we need it desperately because these powerful neighbors are sort of fighting their fights over us. And we can hardly preserve our state because of this happening. So Lebanon's interest in peace, first of all, is to maintain itself as a small state, maintain its sovereignty, or as I put here, restore its sovereignty, because the costs of these wars, including civil wars among Lebanese, have been to really break, you know, at a certain point, you have to say there was no state authority functioning in Lebanon. Now they're trying to restore it. Well, trying to restore sovereignty, trying to restore Lebanese security, they believe they need peace to do that. Second, they're also interested in getting South Lebanon back from the Israelis. You know, just the recent fighting that's been going on. Israel occupied a part of Lebanon, the southern part, in the name of preventing attacks from that area on Israel. Well, whatever justification from the Lebanese point of view, this is totally unacceptable, that Israel is controlling part of southern Lebanon. So they want to get it back, and peace. Therefore, it's in their interest to find some negotiated agreement. They know they can't win it back by military force. Negotiated agreement to get southern Lebanon back. But they also want the Syrians out. The Syrian army is in northeast Lebanon. Not considered by Syria and some Lebanese as occupation, because it's an Arab state, because there was a rationale for it developed within the League of Arab Nations. So somewhat different than Israel's occupation of the south, but nevertheless, the Syrian army is not the Lebanese army. And Lebanese are very discontented with that. They want Syria out, and they think they can't get Syria out unless there's peace. Reconstruction. Tremendous reconstruction is needed in Lebanon because of all the fighting and the wars. And therefore, peace is an interest of Lebanon in order to go ahead with reconstruction and economic development. And to recreate a role for Lebanon in the region. As some of you may know, at one point in the history, for some years, Lebanon was a kind of pearl in the Middle East in terms of its economic role, banking role, and its role as a pluralistic society. And all of that came tumbling down with internal wars and external wars fought over Lebanon. Lebanese still have a vision of their having that kind of role in the region, and peace is essential to it. What are the, sounds great, you know, you read that list by itself and say, well, Lebanon's gonna make peace right away. But the constraints, first, Lebanon is a small, weak, terribly divided state. And small, weak states find it hard to act alone or act bravely for anything. Because they have to look at who's gonna say no to that. Or who's gonna, what the attitude, for instance, if Lebanon wanted to make peace with Israel, what would Syria think? Syria would think no. Because it would feel to Syria as if Lebanon was somehow coming under Israel's influence. And so the Lebanese are very conscious of that, and as a small state, they have to be. Not just the people, but obviously the political leaders. The internal divisions make it very hard for Lebanon to do something courageous and brave and strong, because they've got different factions of Lebanese saying yes, saying no, saying this term, this term, this term. So that's a third thing. So what I say here is that Lebanon simply cannot act alone. It's a state, it's a nation state, it has, in some sense, formally it has sovereignty, but it can't act alone because of the constraints on it, internal and external. What about Jordan? Jordan has the longest border with Israel, if you look at your map. It lost the West Bank, and that's why it's called the West Bank, by the way, because it's the West Bank of the Jordan River. And Jordan controlled that until 1967 when it joined the war with Israel. And Israel conquered or captured the West Bank and has occupied it ever since. So Jordan has a long border. It's very nervous about Israel. So for reasons of its own security, it's interested in King Hussein, who's been the king's for now almost 40 years, since he was 17, has a strong interest and has had a strong interest for some time in a peace agreement, a negotiated peace agreement with Israel, because it would reduce the threat to Jordan that Israel poses. Since 67, it also would mean that the West Bank might be returned to Jordan. Jordan could get back what it lost in that war. So it's concerned about its security, and I'd say security visa Israel, also, by the way, a little bit Syria. And also, and this is a little complication for Jordan, it's concerned about its security vis-a-vis the Palestinian population in Jordan. 65-60% of the Jordanian population are Palestinians. And therefore, the king has a strong interest in resolving the Palestinian issue, because otherwise it might be resolved on his neck, either by the Israelis or by the Palestinians or by a combination of the two. The Israelis, for a long time, some of them have said, yeah, there's Palestine, it's Jordan. Palestinians, there are plenty of Palestinians, let them take Jordan. And some Palestinians have the same idea, by the way. Yeah, let's take Jordan, start there, and then take Palestine back. And so the king is threatened not just by Israel, but also, in a certain sense, by this population, which has a kind of dual loyalty to Jordan, yes, and Palestinians in Jordan, many of them have done fairly well. It's the only Arab country, by the way, that granted Palestinian citizenship. That's the only Arab country that did. And therefore, Palestinians have played a role, and in fact, as some people say, the king may control the army, but Palestinian population controls the economy. And if you look at the banks and the businesses that are, many of them very successful in Jordan, many of them are owned by Palestinians, Palestinian Jordanians, that is, they're Jordanian citizens, but they're Palestinian by birth and therefore have a kind of dual loyalty. So Jordan's interested in solving this thing. They're interested in getting back occupied territories and Jerusalem. Big issue for the king, King Hussein, who traces his ancestors back to the prophet Muhammad. He lost Jerusalem in the 67 war. That has a tremendously volatile, emotional, religious significance for him personally, but for people also, for Arabs, for Muslims particularly. Economic development. When we were living in Jordan, one of the things that we learned was that Crown Prince Hassan, the king's brother, had a whole research center working on post-peace economic planning for Jordan, and Jordan seeing itself as a kind of bridge between the technologically rich, education-rich Israel-Palestinian population and Lebanon, banking system in Lebanon, and the oil-rich Gulf region. Jordan's in between it. And Jordan sees itself having a future in terms of economic development, if there's peace, being a kind of, you know, a middle person, middle operator between the Gulf states and the Mediterranean countries. And there's planning that's gone on about that. So Jordan has that interest. Also, Jordan has always been concerned to keep good relations with the U.S., and it feels that if it could help make peace with Israel, this would help relations with the U.S. But Jordan also has constraints. Again, like Lebanon, not that it's had a big civil war, although it had a kind of civil war with Palestinians in 1970, Jordan is a small, vulnerable state. I remember with my wife, Carol, visiting one of the wonderful sort of ruins, Crusader ruins, up in the north part of Jordan, and we went up, and there was this little tent up there, and he's about a half dozen Jordanian soldiers with a telephone, and we asked the guide, you know, what are they doing? And, oh, their job is to telephone Amman when they see Israeli planes come over. And, you know, we thought to ourselves that sort of almost a mockery of military preparedness, you know, because the telephone call would go something like this to their general. General, we're calling you to tell that the Israeli planes went over 10 minutes ago. You know. Whoa. No, you know, I mean, the technology of warfare, I mean, this business of calling up and saying they went over, you know, they're traveling 900,000 miles an hour, and of course over a very short distance, so bing, it's all over. So that's a constraint, that they're a small state, they're a vulnerable state. You know, they have a population, total population, of about the same size as Israel, 4 million people. They have a military that's fairly efficient, but compared to the Israeli military, nothing. I mean, efficiency, yes. They're good fighters, supposedly. I mean, they're reported to be good fighters and well-organized, but in terms of the technology of modern warfare, they're no match for Israel. They're also no match for Syria. They're no match for anybody in the region. Constraint. Also, the economic problems of Jordan, which are made much worse by the Gulf War. As some of you may know, one of the things that happened in the Gulf War is Jordan took a position on the war with Iraq that was sort of neither this nor that. And neither side went much for positions that were neither this nor that. Iraq wasn't particularly pleased, and the U.S. wasn't particularly pleased. Saudi Arabia wasn't particularly pleased because the king tried to be... He did say that Iraq's invasion was wrong, that the Arab states should negotiate a solution that, including basically Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait, but he was against the American-led force going into the region. Well, that's neither this nor that position, and neither side in the conflict were happy with it. And so what happened was that Jordan got squeezed. Saudi Arabia cut off its aid to Jordan. The U.S. cut off its small amount of aid to Jordan. And then Jordan reaped the awful aftermath of the war because refugees fled from Iraq into Jordan and from Kuwait into Jordan. Jordan got something like 200,000, 300,000 refugees when neither side was particularly interested in helping. So their economic problems are much worse today as a result of the Gulf War, which is both, again, a motivation for seeking peace, but also a constraint because it becomes such a preoccupation to any government to try to deal with these kind of problems. Also, Jordan has an internal opposition, and that is a growing political force in Jordan, not just Palestinian, some Jordanian, non-Palestinian as well, Islamically led, with a religious leadership, that says no to the idea of peace, the peace process. At least some of them absolutely know that they still do not accept the idea of peace with Israel at all, and some know because they think the peace process is so tilted in Israel's favor that it's unrealistic and unworkable, and therefore it's, you know, it's against their principles. Interestingly, and this is just a, you know, kind of note to sort of add to our a little bit more humility about being sure of things, the democratization program which King Hussein has started, which he has sort of renewed in Jordan with opening the parliament, allowing opposition parties, in a certain sense, the democratization process itself has become a constraint on what Jordan can do for peace. Because now that there's allowed to be an opposition, there always was one, but there is allowed to be one, it has more of a role in the society. And the government has to pay more attention to it. Ironically, I mean, we think of, I'm not saying democratization is a bad thing, but it can complicate things some. In a negative way as well as a positive way. And that's, of course, look at our own society, you know. But the alternative is power to, if you're not going to have democracy, and that may be a more complicated question. So there's Jordan, some interests and constraints. Syria. Certainly among the Arab countries, I would say Syria has the most negative reputation in terms of peace. And I would just remind us that part of the reason for that is that Syria relied on the Soviet Union for support for a lot of the Cold War. And obviously that would automatically give it a very negative image in this country. I'm suggesting here that Syria has certain important interests, like the other Arab countries, in peace. First, security. You know, if you've talked to any Israelis, or probably to American Jews, and you've talked about Syria or the Golan Heights, you've gotten this idea. Golan Heights up there, Syrian army on top, Israelis down the bottom, and Syrians firing down on Israelis, and therefore Israel very concerned about its security. Now Israel is on the top of the Golan Heights since the 67 war, and guess what? The Syrians down on the other side of the Golan Heights in Damascus are very, very nervous about having Israeli army on the Golan Heights because it's downhill 40 kilometers to the capital of Syria. And for tank warfare, that's simple matter, particularly Israelis with the skills and technology they have, they're in the streets of Damascus. And one of the interesting things I've done in taking groups on tours to the Middle East is take them to both sides of the Golan Heights, just physically, you know, and sort of look up from both sides and listen to the people around you. Well, Syria's concerned about security, and therefore a negotiated peace could ease that security concern. Second, they want to get back territory they lost, the Golan Heights. And it's been one of the interesting developments in the last year is that Israeli leaders are talking more about their willingness to give back at least part of the Golan Heights if Syria is ready to make a real peace. That's progress in this conflict. President Assad of Syria is saying that he's willing to make peace. He's not willing to spell out the terms yet. And Israel's not willing to say exactly how much they're willing to give back. And there's been a stalemate of that kind. Also, Syria economic development, and this appears practically in every one of these lists as a motivation for peace. And it's interesting, if you talk to prominent Syrian businessmen, you will find that they are almost universally for negotiated peace, just on the basis of the economic development and make it, how they see their investments and profit. And even if they're not motivated by development of their country, they're motivated by development of their firm, their company, their interests. And these interests are all held in some more limited fashion, restricted fashion, in terms of the possible successes and possible growth because of the ongoing conflict with Israel. They're also, Syria, interested more, particularly in recent years, in improving relations with West Europe and the United States. And I say, especially after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. In other words, they lost their prime backer. Not that the prime backer didn't support them anymore, but it just wasn't there anymore. I mean, the Soviet Union's gone, you know? And so they're more interested on a realism basis in opening up more ties with Western Europe and the United States. And therefore, they're more interested in making a negotiated peace agreement because they understand that without a peace with Israel, their chances of having good relations with the U.S. or Western Europe are much less. They're also interested, and this is the second time this will appear in this presentation, they're interested in leading the Arab world. And one of the reasons that Syria was so antagonistic to Egypt having made peace with Israel is that Syria didn't do it. That is to say, who's supposed to be the leader of the Arab world anyway? Damascus or Cairo? And by the way, that goes back centuries. Cairo, Baghdad, and Damascus have been three centers which have vied with each other as the preeminent leader of the Muslim Arab world for centuries. For centuries. And there's a whole psychology about it, you know, among people, not just leadership. It's not just something foisted on people. It's something people they believe, you know, just like Egyptians believe that the Arabs have to come back to us. Syria believes that it should lead the Arab world to making the peace. And part of its interest in the current peace process is to make sure that it seems clear to people that Syria has played the key role. Constraints. I put here, and I don't put it in the case of any of the other Arab countries, and I think this is accurate, that Syria's strong anti-Zionist, that is anti-Jewish nationalist, and anti-imperialist ideology is a constraint on what Syria can do. That, combined with the fact that Syria has very authoritarian rule, means that these ideas that we will never make peace with the Zionist entity, which is the way Israel was referred to for most of the years of this conflict by Syrian press and leaders, these strong ideas that we'll never make peace with the Zionist entity, and the Zionist entity, Israel, is a cat's paw for Western imperialism.
that these were strong ideas in the leadership of Syria, and that Syria has authoritarian rule, so that you can propagandize in an uncriticized way these ideas, means that Syrians have absorbed them. Have absorbed them. So it was interesting, when we went to meet the Syrian deputy ambassador in Washington, a group from our committee, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, she said, in a very interesting statement, she said, in Israel, this was while the Likud government, the more conservative government, was still in power in Israel, she said, in Israel, the people are more ready for peace than the government. She said, but in our country, the government is more ready than the people. And what she meant by that, partly I think she was using it as an excuse for why they couldn't do more for peace. But part of what she meant was that the people still have these very strong ideas that the government, in part, has pumped into them and could pump in because it was authoritarian rule, where they controlled all the media and everything. But people still have these very strong ideas. So for President Assad, who has said for all these years, never, 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 to now say now, 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 people say, well, you know, what's going on? What's going on? And to give you an example of how this works in a practical way, when the Madrid Peace Conference was held, and we saw on our own television the Syrian negotiator, Syrian foreign minister, sitting across from Prime Minister Shamir, not very friendly way, and sort of spitting at each other and cursing at each other and so forth, that view was not shown on Syrian television. The Madrid Peace Conference was mentioned in the media, but the view of the Syrian foreign minister sitting across from the Israeli prime minister was not on Syrian television, and Syria tried to block Jordanian television transmission from coming into Syria so the Syrians could not see that picture. So that there wouldn't have been, to put it specifically, there wouldn't be evidence to the Syrian people that the Syrian government was now in direct talks with this monster enemy that had been for so many years said we'd never talk to, never deal with, da 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 da. So their ideology is a constraint, and I'm saying here, as compared to Jordan in a way, the authoritarian rule and control is a constraint. Because, for instance, the business leaders that I'm talking about who very much want peace in Syria, well, they're careful about how they say it. Just recently, in the last year, there have been stories coming out in the New York Times about, you know, Syrians you meet on the street talking like they're interested in peace. And this is a great revelation. Well, Carol and I, in 1982, 1983, were talking to Syrians, they were interested in peace. But now they're beginning to say this in part because their government is in the negotiations and they feel they can say it. But in a certain sense, authoritarian rule is a constraint, because even those people who strongly thought peace was a good idea wouldn't say so until the top guy, the president, began to say it. And even then, they're not sure, you know, is this not reality? Is this reality or isn't it reality? And if you're a businessman, you go out, I'm the president of Syrian Airlines and I'm for peace with Israel. And then the next week, Assad changes his direction, you know? And you're out there on some branch, swinging. And swinging is not a bad image in terms of Syria, the kind of control that there is in Syria. Tight control by the government. Invisible opposition. There are groups in Syria. You don't see them because it's not an open society in the sense to say Israel is, or United States is, or Jordan is, or Egypt is. You don't see the groups, but they're there, that very much ideologically and deeply in a very gut way are against the peace with Israel. Also, Syria has important relations with Iran. And they have relations there for at least a couple reasons. One is that Iran was opposed to Iraq, and Syria and Iraq have been enemies for years and years, since a party called the Ba'ath Party, which ruled in both countries, split. And if you know anything about left politics, one of the most venomous relationships that you can find is between two branches of the same left party that have split, like the Trotskyites and the Stalinists in the early part of the century. So between the Iraqi Ba'athists and the Syrian Ba'athists, there is no love lost. And because of that, Syria has good relations with Iran, because Iran is antagonistic to Iraq. They also have good relations because Iran provides oil to Syria at discounted prices, a form of aid to Syria. And so that, and you know what Iran's position is with peace on peace with Israel. No, no, no. And therefore, that's a kind of constraint. When does Syria want to risk its relations with Iran for peace with Israel? When, I think they will risk it, but only when they're sure they're going to get all that they need out of it. So that's a constraint on Syria. Now we come to, in a certain sense, the core of the conflict, the Palestinians and Israel. Secretary Schultz, on a visit to Cairo 3 or 4 years ago, was quoted at the airport as saying something that I think was so astoundingly simple and so astoundingly profound, and I wish American policy sort of reflected this insight better. He said at the airport, "What is this conflict about after all? It's a conflict between Zionism," and I again say, because I think some people have sort of very negative things they do as soon as they hear the word Zionism, Zionism is simply Jewish nationalism. It's a conflict between Zionism and Palestinian nationalism over deeply felt claims and legitimate claims to the same land. And then he went on to say that the future of Zionism and Palestinian nationalism are absolutely interdependent. Very good. That's very good. And we come now to this core of the conflict, these two, this people and this state reflecting a people who have had and will have these claims to the same piece of land, that small piece of land that you see on your map. In fact, on one map, it's colored in. There it is, colored in with a shading. But in terms of the claims that people have, you have to include the West Bank in that. That little, whatever, is that a kidney shape or a liver shape, something shape there? The unshaded part called the West Bank. Both the Palestinians and the Jewish people lay claim to that same piece of land. They both, if you dream as a Palestinian of your country's shape, it's that shape. If you dream as a Jew of your country's shape, it's that shape. And there's the rub, that these two peoples have these claims. What about peace between them? The Palestinians have a lot of interest in peace. Peace, any peace that's imaginable, would have to end the occupation of Palestinians. That is military control over the Palestinian people in the West Bank and in Gaza. It would mean some more expression of human rights for Palestinians, basic human rights, including ending their stateless existence. I once heard Shimon Peres, actually the foreign minister of Israel, speak at a synagogue in New York, and he did a marvelous job with a Jewish audience whose main feeling was loyalty. But he did an amazing job at trying to open up their hearts to what it felt like to be a Palestinian. He began his talk by saying, imagine, if you will, tonight, what it's like to be a Palestinian in Gaza. You have no passport. You have no flag. You have no security in the sense that this is your place and no one can come into it. You have no chance of a future in terms of economic development. He went on like that at some length. You might say, well, what is he? Why is he doing that? And you'd think he'd be saying to Jews, come on, support Israel. He was saying support Israel, but as Shimon Peres, part of his idea of what Jewish Americans should do to support Israel is be for peace. That's where he might differ from Yitzhak Shamir. And he knew that with this Jewish audience, he had to do some of this. He had to touch their moral concerns as Jews for the Palestinians. And it was a very interesting talk in that respect. He also, by the way, talked positively about the Soviet Union involved in a peace process. And he knew that many American Jews would be very nervous about that. And he said, look, I don't want the Soviet Union involved either, but I'm more interested in getting a peace process started, even if it includes the Soviet Union, than in not having a peace process at all. So, human rights, the stateless existence. Palestinians have, one of the things the Palestinians get killed for, certainly get arrested for, or get shot at for, is kids trying to pull up a flag on the top of a tree. What flag? The flag of Palestine. Simple stuff, but basic stuff that we all take for granted. Flags go up and down all the time in our country. Palestinians raise a flag and they get shot at. It's illegal to display the Palestinian flag or even the colors of the flag. So Palestinian kids wear t-shirts with those colors on as a sign of defiance to military occupation. So Palestinians have an interest in peace in the sense it would end these conditions. They also have an interest in terms of positively fulfilling their aspirations as a people to have something like a nation state. They've not had that. They want that. They've wanted that. They're maybe now willing to accept a small one, but they want it. They want that sense that this is ours. Our flag will fly here. And we can be proud of it. And our identity as a people can be reflected in this place and in this government, whatever the name of it. Economic and social development. The Palestinians, next to Israeli Jews, have the highest level of education in the region. have the highest level of education, and some now, some studies show that they have a higher level per capita than Israeli Jews. And they have a lot of potential for economic and social development, but as long as they're under military occupation, the possibility of economic development is almost nil. I mean, it's sort of the nature of military occupation that the occupier is not going to help the occupied develop. And indeed, that's what Israel has done, not help the Palestinians develop, and in some ways squash any chance of development. So they have that interest in peace. They also have the interest that once they have something, call it a state. I think it's fair and right that they should have something called a state. But say it's not called a state. Say it's called an entity, if you need something, you know? Once they have that, it also allows for the possibility that Palestinians in other places, in Syria, Jordan, Egypt, the United States, can feel like their existence is normalized. As long as the conflict continues, Palestinians in Syria, for instance, who don't have citizenship, in a certain sense, part of the problem in getting granted citizenship is there's still this war going on. And so the part of the interest of Palestinians in peace is to normalize the status of Palestinians wherever they live, and to allow Palestinians to come to this small place and to feel this is our place, even though most of them who live elsewhere are not going to move there. But they might go there, just as American Jews, for instance, go to Israel and feel a sense of, this is our place. Also, the Palestinians have a vision of the positive role they can play in the region. Right now, they're kind of playing a role of, if you don't solve our problem, we're going to be trouble for you. That's their role with Israel and with the Arab states. But they have a vision of a positive role they can play. The main person in Cairo who's been advising the Palestinian negotiators in Washington, a person, official of the PLO, and therefore not officially in the negotiating team, is a man who owns a computer company and produces children's books. This is a PLO official, by the way, not your typical image of a PLO official. Owns a computer company and produces children's books. Well, he has ideas about the role he'll play as a Palestinian businessman in relationship to the Palestinian state and the Palestinian economy and its role in the region. But the Palestinians have constraints. First, maybe their biggest constraint is the deep pain and bitterness that Palestinians have over the creation of Israel, which, whatever else you say about it, and in some ways to me, the creation of Israel out of the ashes of the Holocaust is one of the miracles of the human spirit. But you have to also say that it happened or was done at tremendous price to the Palestinians. And there's a deep sense of bitterness, a deep sense of injustice. And for Palestinians to give up the idea that they will have that whole shape as Palestine is a very hard, wrenching, emotional thing for them to do, even today. Even today. And as I said, I would say in a synagogue, if this were a synagogue, Jews should well understand how long people can remember their home. And it's an amazing thing. It's a wonder, in some ways, a wonderful thing. It's a testimony to the human spirit. Now, of course, the reason why Jews don't like to think of Palestinians having that as their home is because it's so contradictory with the existence of Israel. And I can understand that. Just the way Palestinians don't like to, they want to think of Jews who came there as sort of colonializers rather than people coming home. It's more convenient. It works better morally, if you can simplify it that way. That it's our home and their interlopers. Or as the Israelis would think, it's our home and the Palestinians can go live in other Arab countries. So one constraint is the pain and the deep bitterness. Another is the divisions among the Palestinians. They don't all agree on what should be done. Partly because of this pain, there are many Palestinians who still believe the idea of a compromise with Israel is wrong. That we should fight and resist and keep going until eventually Israel is destroyed. And there's divisions within the PLO being the main nationalist organization. There's divisions within the PLO, and there's division outside the PLO, with this Islamic group, Hamas particularly, that has grown up in recent years, particularly in Gaza, but some in the West Bank, opposed to any kind of compromise with Israel. Another thing is that is a constraint on the Palestinians in terms of pursuing peace is what they believe, and I'd say is fair, the bias in the Madrid peace process. By bias, I mean the fact that not only Israel, but also the U.S., along with the Soviet Union, but clearly the U.S. being the main sponsor of this process, has said in its official statements from time to time that it opposes the idea of a Palestinian state, that it has not yet, the U.S. has not yet supported the right of self-determination of the Palestinian people, even that principle, and that the U.S. opposed the idea of the PLO being officially in the negotiations. Well, all three of those things, as viewed by the Palestinians, are clearly biased against the Palestinians and then make the Madrid peace process feel very biased. And so that's a constraint in terms of the Palestinians' confidence or eagerness or readiness to go ahead in that process and make a peace agreement, because they feel like it's tipped already very much against them. And then also last, their vulnerability and their insecurity. I mean, you know, a part of what makes sometimes a country able to make peace is that it's strong. Sometimes. And I'll come to Israel in a minute. Sometimes it can work the other way. But partly you feel sort of a confidence. You know, you don't have to just, you don't get so easily pushed around. You can decide. Well, the Palestinian people under military occupation, it's very hard to make those kind of decisions. Israel. Israel clearly has interest in peace. The first being security and recognition. Just imagine living in a country officially legitimized and recognized by the United Nations in 1948, 47, 48, 49, but until this day, only one of the neighboring countries to Israel recognizes the existence of Israel. Imagine what it's like to be an Israeli Jew living in a country for that long that none of your neighbors, now except one, Egypt, even recognize. When we were in Jordan in 84, we watched the Olympics on television, the parade comes along. Guess what country's not in the parade? Remember I talked about Syrian television? Yeah, exactly. The parade comes and all the initials come right along. Israel, whoop, gone. Not there. Edited out in Jordanian television. Now, that's, imagine what that's like to the psyche of Jews. Remember, this is a people for whom this century, literally, there was a threat to whether they would exist. So, how that non-recognition by their Arab neighbors echoes the threat to their very existence that came in a politically organized state power form in this century, and then the centuries before that, the sort of wish that the Jews would disappear. Imagine what that means in terms of insecurity. Abba Ibn, former foreign minister of Israel, once responded to an American political scientist who said, in a typically sort of hiding American political scientist way, well, now, Mr. Ibn, you know, don't you think that Israeli Jews have an inordinate and abnormal concern for security? And Abba Ibn just responded very quietly. He said, I agree. We do have an inordinate and abnormal concern for security, but then the history of the Jewish people is not a normal history. So security as an interest in peace is a very powerful one that Israel could be recognized and accepted as a nation among nations in the Middle East and could have secure borders. Second, that it could have normal relations with its neighbors, that it could trade, that it could sell and buy and in all the things that state neighbors do, they could enter into negotiations over a NAFTA agreement with the Arab states. You see, we sort of sit here and say, oh, we're going to have a NAFTA agreement. But Israel, you know, for 40 years has been waiting for a chance to have that kind of chance to negotiate a NAFTA agreement on trade relations with its neighbors. But its neighbors have said nothing, no trade, nothing, except Egypt. Economic and social development. Israel's got a lot of problems, including a large number of Russian Jews who have immigrated, and they have to deal with them. They have to create jobs. Well, as long as there's this war situation, the chances of their creating jobs and housing and schools and so forth are less. Move away. This is an interesting one, but I think it's a very important one, a growingly important one in Israel. Move away from the heavy reliance on the U.S. That is an interest in peace in order to move away from heavy reliance on the U.S. Why? In part because at the end of the Cold War, most Israeli analysts, and I think a good number of Israeli people, realized that their chances of getting large amounts of U.S. aid in the future were much smaller when the Cold War ended than before it ended, because Israel was seen by the U.S. as a country reliable in the U.S.'s fight with the Soviet Union, and therefore would get more aid. With the end of the Soviet Union, that's no longer motivation for the U.S. Also, given our domestic problems, people are not enthusiastic about foreign aid. And people can say, well, I'm for cutting aid to Israel because I think it would help Israel move toward peace. But frankly, most Americans are for cutting aid to Israel simply because they're for cutting aid to everybody. And it's just a huge support for cutting aid, period. In fact, one of the ways that foreign aid bill has been gotten through the Congress in past years is because the Jewish lobby pressed for aid to Israel and it was part of the foreign aid bill. And so people who supported foreign aid to third world countries or African countries oftentimes had to work with the Jewish lobby because the two things were combined. And I'm saying that part of the interest Israelis have in peace today is that they're realizing that they can't be so dependent on USA, and they will be unless there can be a peace agreement. Improve global relations. Israel relations with Asian countries, African countries, in a certain way have been hampered tremendously by this conflict with Arabs, with the Arab states and Palestinians. To the extent it can be resolved, their economic relations, diplomatic relations, social relations with these countries improve. And finally, to resolve the moral contradiction in Zionism and Jewish nationalism. If you read Zionist writers, there's a tremendous amount of idealism in it, in Jewish nationalism. And the idea that Jewish nationalism has to succeed on the backs of another people, to many Jewish nationalist thinking, is an appalling idea. Appalling. And therefore, if there could be peace, this contradiction in Jewish nationalism could be resolved. Now, I'll come back on the constraints to say that there are other Zionists who don't give a damn for that contradiction. But for many Jewish nationalists, this moral contradiction where Israel has to succeed on the backs of the Palestinians is an intolerable moral problem. And therefore, there's an interest in peace to resolve that contradiction. But Israel, too, has constraints. First, very much like the Palestinians, the deep pain and the fears that Israelis have from their history, both as Israel in the Middle East and as a Jewish people, constrain their ability to move courageously and bravely and imaginatively for peace. I'm not equating Palestinian suffering and Jewish suffering. I find it absolutely useless to measure one people's suffering against another. I find it absolutely essential that any of us try to stand in the shoes, which we can't do, but try to stand in the shoes of both peoples to see how their suffering has affected them and how their suffering affects their capacity to make peace. Arafat has called recently, you've seen the newspapers, for a peace of the brave, which is right. He's right. It is needed, a peace of the brave. But one has to remember that for it is only the last 5 years that Arafat officially, in behalf of the Palestinian movement, has said they're prepared to accept Israel's existence. From 48 to 88, the position was Israel must go. So it takes time for people to come back around to the peace of the brave, to develop enough courage and enough trust and so forth to say peace of the brave. Deep pain, fears from the history. Second constraint, the insecurity of a small state and compounded by Jewish history. As I said before, Israel has the strongest army in the region. It can defeat and has shown it can defeat each Arab country and all Arab countries together. But if you think that's enough to give psychological security to a people, you don't understand. I mean, any more than, frankly, maybe we shouldn't think of it in terms of Americans. Look at the power we've had in the world militarily. And yet there's a nervousness sometimes among us, you know, about security, about the threat of the Russians. Israel has the military power to win the next war and the next war after that, and the Syrians know it, and everybody knows it. But they're still insecure, partly their smallness and partly their history. Third, overconfidence in military power. I said before that if you're strong, you can make peace, but it's also true that sometimes if you're strong, you think you don't have to. And so I think many Israelis, in a certain sense, they've lived with this conflict for so long. They've lived with occupation, you know, for 25 years since 67. We're still around. We're still basically, you know, surviving and doing all right. You got problems, but so why do we have to give anything? So the overconfidence which comes with military power makes you feel like you don't have to compromise. They've got an internal opposition. There are Israeli Jews who are against giving back an inch of land to the Arabs. They didn't recognize us, they didn't make peace with us, they fought against us, we won, it's ours, period. No end of argument. And then an ideological back support for that, where extreme, more extreme nationalist groups in Israel say this land is ours. Never mind that we just won it in a war, it's always been ours. It's promised by God, or it's ours as it both has a secular and a religious version of it. And these groups are very much opposed to peace. All right, I'm going to stop. I hope that gives you a sense, some sense of the parties, and that the not only sort of remembering sort of the names of the parties that are in this, but that each of them has some strong interest in peace, but also some constraints that keep them from, if you will, being imaginative and creative and doing what might be necessary for peace.